from the high desert and the great American Southwest. I want to bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever part of the world you may be in all 24 time zones covered by this program, which is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. We've got a really, really packed show tonight. Linda Moulton Howe with John Anthony West. But first, she'll have a really chilling report for you, an audio on a sighting. It's incredible. And then in the next hour, we've got a monster hunter here. I believe it's Peter Pootkammer, who is a monster hunter. He's got a lot of cuts, eyewitness type stuff that we're going to play for you. A monster hunter. So it should be a very, very interesting night. I just want to first, I want to thank the people of New York City and Los Angeles, California. As always, I try and keep you updated abreast of what's going on when we get ratings in. And current ratings period is breaking now like crazy. And we are totally bucking the trend now. You know, a lot of news talk stations, because of the post 9/11 business, took a bit of a hit in the ratings. But let me tell you, folks, our program, I woke up this morning, my wife woke me up, said Phil Boyce from WABC called, and call him back. And I got on there and he said, oh, Art, number one, men, check it out, Art, men, 12 plus 9.6 share, which in New York, that's, I mean, like totally huge. 25-54, a 7.8 share, 77% increase. I wrote these down as he said them. 35-54, number one with an 88% increase. 35-64, number one with a 10.3 share and a 49% increase. That's awesome. Totally awesome at a time when the others were, you know, were sort of turning around. In Los Angeles, a 7.7 share for adults 25 to 54. Awesome. So, listen, I want to thank everybody in New York City and Los Angeles, and we'll kind of keep you informed, you know, as the ratings come in. But really, truly, from the heart, everybody, for being here, for listening, for supporting everything the way you have, thank you so very much. Get ready, because we've got a big report coming in from Linda. Well, all right, she's been a science reporter for us, for, I say us, Whitley on Dreamland, of course, and here on Coast for years and years and years now, a lot of years. She has written any number of books on essentially things that go bump in the night, the unexplained, crop circles, animal mutilations, that sort of thing. She has had award-winning documentaries, and it goes on and on. She is Linda Moulton Howe, and when she's here, like Mr. Buffett, people listen, because she does the hard science. So what you're about to hear is pretty amazing from somebody of hard science, Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, hi.
Thanks, Art. And I am still haunted by what happened a week ago on Sunday night, April 14th, 2002.
Where were you?
I was in the Ozark National Forest of Northwest Arkansas with eight other people who had driven up there at the from the Eureka Springs Earth Mysteries Conference, and there was no moon. The sky was absolutely clear and vivid with stars. We were there to look for the mysterious lights that have long been reported in the Piney River Valley, 10 miles north of Dover, which is about an hour northwest of Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Four of us were at one end of a long wall above the valley, and four more witnesses were at the other end of the wall. I was staring down into the dark valley looking for light activity when I heard pilot and flight mechanic Bob Martin's voice from the furthest group say, "Oh, my God."
All right. You know what, Linda? We better warn people. Because of the spontaneous nature of what you're about to hear, a very serious sighting that occurred, you're going to hear it. There's going to be some bad language. So,
well, I actually edited out most of the emotional swear words.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
I was just going to say.
One, I think.
All right, well, we're going to leave it in there anyway. Some edited out. But you can imagine when people see what Linda's talking about here, they issue, you know, they do what humans do. Okay, Linda.
Yes, it was pretty emotional. We all started asking, what, where, because the night was so dark, we could not even see each other. And Bob ran over to us and said, look up in the sky. I was astonished to see what looked exactly like three stars moving very slowly in a large triangular formation through the surrounding stars. It was not like anything that I'd ever seen before. Don Kreinbrink, an industrial equipment service engineer from Mississippi, had his video camera, and he turned it on and recorded a few frames of this moving triangle and one clear one that you can now see at my website, www.earthfiles.com. Go to the headlines page and scroll down to tonight's story about these unidentified moving stars above Dover, Arkansas. Click and you will see one real video frame of what we're talking about that lasted for about 3 minutes in the sky. Now, here is a brief excerpt from the videotape audio, and it will be followed by comments of these eyewitnesses.
A sighting as it occurs.
They're huge.
I think you need to look, look further south.
Look,
see those two bright stars? They're kind of moving.
Yeah, nuts, man.
Holy shit.
Look, look, right up here. Look, a triangle there.
Yeah. It's huge and it's just creeping.
Yeah. If that's a triangle, it must be miles across.
Mother. Huh? Isn't that cool? They have to be in formation. It cannot be one thing, can it?
I don't think
it would be huge.
Brent Cater, retired TV broadcast engineer from Clarksville, Arkansas.
And what I saw, when I finally did see them, were three lights in a triangle formation, very high up in the stars, seemingly. All three lights seemed to stop almost directly overhead.
Don Kreinbrink, service engineer for industrial equipment in South Haven, Mississippi.
Those points of light look just like the stars, and they formed an asymmetrical triangle. They didn't seem to be all arranged evenly, but I was really impressed with how large it was and how slow it was moving. I was sort of blinded by the screen on my video camera, but I pointed it as best I could up to where the three points of light were, and tried to get something, but there was no way to see on the video camera screen the objects, because it just doesn't show small points of light very well.
Bob Martin, pilot and aircraft mechanic from Olivet, Missouri.
It could have been huge, because I really had no reference point for them up against the stars. They were just big and bright, and they could have stretched for miles.
And that would tend to support the idea that this was a formation of three objects moving in exquisite precision over 3 minutes, not any kind of a large object, especially since all of us seem to see the stars in and around the moving stars.
Yes, ma'am.
Nancy Martin, corporate marketing assistant in Olivet, Missouri.
They were moving too slowly to be satellites. And they moved to almost directly overhead, and then they faded to a brownish color and kind of flickered out.
Did you, watching through binoculars, note if all three lights, when they stopped, did they fade out together, or did one fade out and then another and another?
They seemed to fade out just slightly behind each other. It was 11:05 when they flickered out. That's when I said, it's 11:05.
About 5 minutes after the lights went out, I noticed an F-15 flew overhead with an extremely bright strobe light, following their same trajectory.
Hmm.
And this guy was flat out flying. I mean, he was probably subsonic, but I bet he was doing over 600 knots.
Deanna Ming, TV Studio Tech, Memphis, Tennessee.
I think it was something alien, and I think it was something that was attempting to be hidden, but maybe we were supposed to see it. I'm not sure.
Stephen Kelbs, maintenance engineer in Wood River, Illinois.
It was just exhilarating. It's the only way I can put it for myself. It was just very exhilarating. In that particular moment, I just never felt so alive. I was witness to something special. I had adrenaline flowing through my veins like never before, and I was just so happy to be able to witness that, and I just kept thinking I wanted to see more.
Joanne Scarpellini, retired researcher, assistant in neurology and neurochemistry at Washington University Medical School in St. Louis.
What are they? What kind of mechanics are here? Who has something that we haven't, or at least as far as I know, don't have a clue as to propulsion and so on? Because these things can stop in flight and then continue. And it sure wasn't a helicopter, and I think that's about the only thing we have that can do that. What are they here to do? How long have they been here? Why are they doing it? There's just no end to the questions.
There are NASA satellites called clusters launched in July 2000 to study the magnetosphere. There are four of them that travel polar orbits together, and I wondered if cluster satellites could explain the strange triangle formation. So I contacted Melvin Goldstein, project manager of the cluster satellite program at NASA Goddard in Greenbelt, Maryland.
And we pulled up the orbit here, and starting on day 104, which is April 14th, and running through day 105, which is the 15th, spacecraft are predominantly in the day side of the Earth, and throughout the entire day 104 till the beginning of April 15th, they're out in front of the Earth on the day side, and it isn't until very late in the day on the 15th, which is Monday, that they actually go into the night side of the Earth. So it doesn't seem plausible.
So they could not, the Cluster 2 satellites could not explain that sighting on Sunday of April 14th?
No. I don't think that's going to be viable as an explanation. I really have no idea what phenomena these people saw. There aren't that many satellites that are visible by naked eye, but there are a few.
But we just eliminated that cluster 2 could not.
Yeah, with the cluster is almost impossible to see with the naked eye. I mean, it's been seen with telescopes, but I would have been very surprised if somebody actually had managed to see it with naked eye or even with binoculars.
Besides, Linda, they don't stop.
Yes, they don't stop, and people ask about Iridium satellites. It's the same thing I learned from him. You cannot see those with the naked eye either.
You can see a flash of them every now and then.
But not what we were seeing steadily for 3 minutes.
Not a chance. Not a chance, Linda.
It was it does something to your mind when you see something like a part of the sky actually seem to be moving, almost creeping as if it were using the sky itself as camouflage.
Yes, let me ask you a question, Linda. Did you see anything, when you consider the inside of the triangle as it moved, were you able to see stars through it?
Most of us seem to think that, yes, we did, that it was just creeping through the star field, so that it was stars, like stars moving in the star field. A couple of people thought that they could see with their eyes some slight aberrations in and around where the three different star points were moving. A couple compared it to looking through heat waves or water, but I don't think that the entire group saw that, but that was two of the reports.
Linda, there is a report right now that at the Skunk Works, they have a plane. I'm getting reports of people in Southern California hear planes go over them, directly over them, and they look up, and they don't see them. And there's this technology that is being rumored now that they really can make them optically, essentially invisible.
Well, this art was as if you're looking up to a star field at night, and that it is not anything low. It is as if the very stars themselves are moving. And I just also got a email coming in saying, this is from a Michael Rapson in Bendigo, Victoria, Australia. And he's just looked at my website story, and he says that twice he has seen what he thought were stars suddenly move in horizontal paths, stop, move again. They've seen several stars moving back and forth along horizontal planes, stopping each time, and on all occasions, they look like ordinary stars before they began to move and stop, and these look like ordinary stars. And what all of us have talked about that night and since is, who or what could have been in those three star points of light, if anything, and if they are programmed by another intelligence to monitor this planet, do they move once a year, once every 6 months, once every 45 days? Did we see something that happens only occasionally? And if they are monitoring, what are they monitoring and why? What if a non-human intelligence has been monitoring Earth for thousands or millions of years? Could ancient people in Egypt and Samaria have seen formations of stars move long ago? Could moving lights in the sky have provoked their obsession with constellations? And one of the points to bring up right now before I introduce our next guest is that the pilot, Bob Martin, said that where he, because he's the first one who saw these stars emerge moving, they came right out of where the constellation Auriga is, A-U-R-I-G-A, and moved in those 3 minutes slowly to the constellation Leo, which is where they seem to stop and fade out.
That's an incredible story with an incredible, impressive array of witnesses, of which you were one.
Yes, and the constellations, there was a starting point and a stopping point in what we know as constellations, and now what I'd like to have is to join
us. Just before you do, Linda, I should note for the audience that, Linda, I'm sorry, but we've killed your website temporarily.
Oh.
I'm getting 1,000 fast blasts, and we took it down like a mafia-led weight on a bad guy, you know?
Well, hopefully the server will get themselves back up. They know that.
You will recover.
Okay, yes. And joining us now to talk about this question and other news about the Sphinx and Red Pyramid is Egyptian researcher and director of the Ancient Wisdom Foundation, John Anthony West, who wrote a great book entitled Serpent in the Sky. John, welcome to Coast to Coast.
He's a wild man.
Thank you, Linda. And Art, hello.
Yes, hi.
Well, you know, you've heard the Dover story now, John, yep. And this comment from Bob Martin, the pilot, that he could see this triangle of stars seem to emerge right out of this constellation Auriga and move into Leo. Is there anything in Egyptian literature that suggests ancient knowledge about star formations that appear to move?
Well, in a manner of speaking, yes. There's a, generally not, but there's one ancient prophecy, it's about 2,000 years old, that's very dire. It seems to be promising the end of civilization and complete disruption on everything on Earth, environmental disaster and so on. Hmm. And there's one passage that says, then will the Earth no longer stand unshaken and the sea will bear no ships. Heaven will not support the stars in their orbits, nor will the stars pursue their constant course in heaven. All voices of the gods will of necessity be silenced and dumb. The fruits of the earth will rot. The soil will turn barren, etc., etc.
Wow.
Now, this could be figments of imagination. It could be, I mean, this is a prophecy. So who knows what they mean? It could be a reference to a still earlier time when some kind of cosmic catastrophe occurred and it looked as though the earth might have been out of kilter, but it looked as though the stars were not pursuing their course. So,
John, the one thing that might do that would be a shift in orbit or a pole shift, something
could
like
be.
That.
That's right. Yeah. Or in the work on catastrophe theory, an asteroid strikes the Earth and it wobbles or something of the sort. Really don't know, but certainly the Egyptians were obsessed with following the stars. I mean, astrology plays a tremendous part in Egypt from beginning to end. The temples are very carefully sighted and oriented to equinoxes and solstices and stars and that sort of thing. So,
and John, if they had actually seen something like we saw at that Dover Valley last Sunday, where the stars seemed to be moving literally in the sky, probably translators through these 4,000 or 5,000 years would have somehow ended up editing that out?
Well, in, very likely, because ancient Egyptian is a language that had to be reconstructed from scratch. And, you know, most Egyptologists are, I mean, very erudite in terms of translations, but most of them are not terribly, let's say, receptive to the idea of UFOs and that sort of thing. So it's very hard to tell, and I'm not an expert in hieroglyphs, that, you know, there may be references that simply are considered to be mistakes on the part of the ancient scribes, and...
When we come back, Art, we'll go back and back further and further in time.
Okay, that's exactly what we want to do, and that's what they're doing in Egypt right now, but they're doing it so they're being dragged every inch through every minute back in time because of what it means. It's absolutely fascinating what's going on in Egypt right now, and John Anthony West is definitely the person to tell us what's going on. Been a lot of changes. Zahi Hawass is now exalted with a new title. I think John Linda probably will have that. We'll be right back.
Be it sight, sound, smell, or touch, there's something inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch, or the scent of a sound, or the strength of an oak with roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories hoard, and to use them to help us.
Want to take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 775-727-1222 or call the wildcard line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
By the way, those who missed Hal Lindsey last night, not to worry, he's rescheduled for this coming Monday. Right now, Linda Moulton Howe and John Anthony West are here. Do you suppose they've been watching us since we've been here? That could be. If the Egyptians knew of something. And, of course, you take that and mix it up with what Linda just saw and millions of others. I'm getting fast blasted about a lot of people who have seen what Linda's seen. So she might want to give out her email address to communicate with the other contactees. Well, that's a little bit of a stretch, but it's a kind of contact, isn't it? All of that coming right up. Stay right there.
Want to take a ride?
You've already said that. Instead, let's do this. Stay right there. Well, all right, very quickly, I'm getting inundated, Linda, with a fast blast from people who have seen exactly what your group just described. You better give out an email address. There's going to be a lot of confirmations for you from the audience.
Yes, thank you. That's one of the things I was hoping for, and my email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. That is the same as my website, www.earthfiles.com, where these reports tonight are posted. And for people who would like to fax me, I'm at 215-491-9842. That's 215-491-9842.
Right, and Linda, our other guest, John Anthony West, has provided a link which we've got up on the website right now, which gives you a virtual tour of Egypt. I mean, it's awesome. So, audience ought to get and see that too.
Yes, that is an amazing website, and John also has a website for his research and his communication, which is www.jawest.com.
We've got a link for that. We've got a link for that also.
Oh, great.
At artbell.com.
And I thought also, picking up on something you said, Art, about idea of some kind of polar shifts on the planet sometimes being involved. I have just done a fascinating interview that will be on Dreamland this coming weekend with somebody on this breaking news about anomalies in our Earth's magnetic field that I hope people will listen to. And that is a part of this changing Earth.
Okay. John Anthony, big doings in Egypt. I'm hearing from, I got a call from Daniel Brinkley earlier.
Oh, right.
Who said Zahi has some big new title, and I'm sure you've got it.
That's right.
And that they're after, they're talking about all these gold mummies, but according to Banyan, now maybe you can knock this rumor down, but these gold mummies, he says, are kind of a distraction that they're providing in Egypt right now because there's something a lot more interesting going on. Is that true?
Well, in my view it is, yes, because this is just another, this is more standard Egyptology in a sense. But Art, can I just say that Linda didn't give out that website for our virtual video things. You just gave out mine. Can I put it in here?
Oh, yes.
It's www.magicalegypt.com.
Yeah, as I said to my audience, though, John, if they just go to tonight's guest info, we've got the
link. They'll get it there? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry. Okay,
yeah,
anyway.
That's why.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, Zahi has now been made the director of antiquity. So he's now the big boss there, but he's kept his office on the Giza Plateau. He goes there every, a couple of days every week. So he's the man in charge now, which, from my point of view, is actually good, believe it or not. I mean, a couple of years ago, this was war, all-out war. It was like Israel and Palestine.
I recall very well, yes.
But in the last few years, in fact, when we were together on that Alaska cruise, the thaw was starting to happen then. And since that time, we've become... It's better than just polite. I mean, we're actually on very good personal terms, even though he's as publicly as opposed to our theories as ever.
Would you use the word friend?
I would, actually. We go out to dinner together, and we go out to dinner together and smoke the shisha. And
When you go into Zai's office, he puts his coffee down for you that would send you into orbit.
I like that coffee, but he puts the coffee down. I mean, I go to the office, and he invites me in and so on, and this is what makes me... this is very good because we now have planned this big geologist panel because the crux of this whole theory of breaking it open, of battering down the door to the ivory tower, is a panel of geologists who corroborate all of this water weathering work that we've been doing all of these years.
And this means we're talking about the age of things like the Sphinx, right?
That's right, yes, of course.
And just for a moment, John, could you please explain the story about the two British geologists who have recently and independently followed your footsteps over there, studied the Sphinx, and they are concluding that there's water weathering as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You see, the academics have all along said, oh, well, Robert Schock is the only one who believes this. Well, now there are two English geologists, David Coxall and Colin Reeder, who, independent of each other and of ourselves, I don't know these people, went over there to look at just this question, the water weathering, and they back it without any reservation whatsoever, that there's only one thing that can be responsible for this dramatic weathering on the Sphinx, and that's rain, lots and lots of rain pouring down over the Sphinx and then spilling over the enclosure wall and creating that huge weathering that we see. The dating is still open to question. This is something to be solved later on. I mean, we can't approach that at the moment. But the whole idea, because the argument is, all of these other geologists haven't been there, is to bring a panel of a dozen or so absolutely qualified, uncommitted, objective geologists with the right kind of specialties over there to look simply at the water weathering, and not just at the Sphinx. We've collected about a dozen pieces of pretty dramatic evidence over the years that, in fact, Schock presented 2 years ago at the Geological Society of America's meeting in Reno, to a packed house of geologists, all of whom were very, very supportive of the whole idea. So we feel we're not far from establishing that once and for all. So we're putting together this panel. There'll also be an archaeoastronomer on it and a forensic engineer to look at some of the building problems.
But bottom line is, John, as Linda said, and you sort of said too, that means the world was once a really, really different place.
I'm sure it was.
Right? Right, Linda?
And you've got the same ancient weathering puzzle inside the Red Pyramid at Dashur, don't you?
Well, that's a big piece of the puzzle. It's not quite the same weathering, but inside this Red Pyramid, it just opened to the public a few years ago. There's a very strange-looking chamber. It looks megalithic, like something out of England or Wales or Scotland. Mm. And the point is that it's made of roughly cut blocks, fairly large, not huge, but it looks megalithic, and those rocks are weathered. They're not weathered the same way as the Sphinx, but they're weathered through long periods of exposure to the open air. And, of course, this is in the middle of the pyramid, so they can't have weathered once the pyramid was built. So we're absolutely certain of this, that this is an older construction, whether as old as the Sphinx, I don't know, but it's an older period of Egyptian civilization. It was there first, and then the Egyptians built the Red Pyramid around it. And the Red Pyramid's very early. It's before the Great Pyramid. So we're actually talking about a lot of pieces of evidence that come together to support this whole theory. In other words, that the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians themselves, knew their own history, and they talk about prior reigns, thousands and thousands of years, when Egypt was ruled first by what they call the gods themselves, and then by a shadowy group called the Companions of Horus. And we're talking here about many, many thousands of years. So this water weathering theory is not simply a question of, well, how old is the Sphinx? Who cares? It's a question of overturning, in its entirety, everything we've been taught in school about the evolution of human civilization.
And John, in 1991, when you and Dr. Schock went to Egypt and you made the report about the water weathering, I think that Dr. Schock suggested that the Sphinx might be at least 8,000 years old or older, and now you are thinking that it might be as old as 36,000 years?
Well, I am, but this comes from the Egyptian texts themselves, actually, or hints in the Egyptian texts themselves. But the question of dating is really, really, is very complex, and Schock picks the 8,000 years because, let's say, that's the most conservative date that the data will allow. But he says himself, he said, well, that's an absolute minimum. But I, for a variety, as I say, of complex reasons, think it's a lot older than that, and older than the 10,000 B.C. date that Bovall and Hancock picked also.
Holy mackerel.
But this remains to be seen. First things first, is to get the geologists over and get it accepted that this is water weathering, and therefore we have to think about redating this thing.
And John, what new technology is in place that can help nail stone aging that has been so difficult in the past?
Yeah, well, there's a technique called isotopic analysis, which is to stone what carbon dating is to wood. In order to do it, it measures the radioactive decay of trace elements in the rock. So what you need is three pieces of rock of the same kind of rock. One, virgin bedrock that's never been exposed to the air. Then another piece, when you know when that's cut, let's say New Kingdom, 1200 BC. And then rock X, we don't know. And then by measuring the isotopes of beryllium, cadmium, there are a few other elements that work with this, and triangulating, you should be able to figure out what the date of rock X is. Only problem to date is, or big problem, I should say, is that no one is really sure if this will give dates in terms of, let's say, thousands of years rather than terms of tens of thousands of years. So whether or not it's good enough to tell us that something is 20,000 B.C. or 30,000 B.C. or something like that, we're not sure till we can do it.
Can't they ultimately, though, John, calibrate that using other dating methods to see if it's accurate in the nearer term?
Not that I know of, but you know, Art, I put these kinds of things in the back burner because the hardest thing to do in Egypt if you're trying to do research is to get samples for this kind of thing.
Yes,
so
I know.
I don't really, as I said, first things first, and first thing is to get this water weathering thing established once and for all.
Should we be believing and following what Zahi and company are suggesting, that we keep our eyes on in Egypt, or are there things going on perhaps elsewhere that they'd rather not have us looking real hard at?
Oh, not that I know of. I used to think that something was being concealed, but quite frankly, I don't think so. And knowing Zahi as well as I know him now, I think that there was something really important. He's very patriotic, Zahi.
Oh, yes.
Anything that's good for Egypt,
That's
he
right.
will do. And I find it very hard to imagine him sitting on something that he doesn't want us to know. I used to think otherwise, but I really do now believe that if there was something major, and you know, Zahid, you know, he likes to be in the, he likes to be in front of the public. And
he does.
He'd be there.
He does, but he's also very protective and patriotic of his own country, as as he rightly should be. Now, if there's something that comes up that challenges what Egyptians believe to have been true, I mean, after all, you look at us and the Brookings report and all the rest of that, and how would Egypt be any different?
Yeah. But,
and John, on this most recent trip, didn't you talk with Zahi Hawass about this science panel?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Can you tell us what his reaction was?
Sure. Yeah, well, I've mentioned this to him for over the last few years, and he's been very supportive of the whole thing and said, we'll put the panel together and come to me. But in fact, it was only until only recently that I came across a fellow with exactly the right kinds of credentials and the right kind of interest, a man who's a who is independent of ourselves, Ashok and myself, and he is a geoarchaeologist. That's what he does for a living. He studies the geology of ancient, you know, archaeological sites, and he's very interested in this theory and very keen to get over there and check it firsthand with a team. So he and Ashok will be putting the team together. Zahi, I've invited, in fact, I prefer it this way, to put some geologists of his own on there so it doesn't look as though we've stacked the deck, and bring a dozen of the or so of them over there. And then, of course, I've got to find the money. That's what my Ancient Wisdom Foundation is for, to put the money together to get these guys over here. It's not as though we're building a particle accelerator or, you know, building a missile defense shield. It's relatively financially small pickings, but still I've got to put it together. And then get us over there and get these scientists to report on it. And then we proceed from there.
And John, you made a very interesting point when we were talking earlier about that you are now in the challenge of where people were in dinosaur studies years ago. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure, Linda. Yeah, a little bit. For hundreds of years, people were finding dinosaur bones, and they were arguing over it. What is this? Is it a hoax? Is it a gift from God? Are they giants? And the idea that they were extinct animals was around for a long time, but nobody would accept it. And suddenly, I think the date is precisely 1838. I forget the name of the geologist. It might have been Cuvier. But somebody said the right thing at the right time, and all of a sudden, everybody said, oh, yes, this is what we've known all along. It's an extinct animal. And suddenly, once the penny dropped in the slot, within a couple of decades, the museums of the world were filled with dinosaurs because everybody was looking for them now that they were established. So we think this the same sort of thing about the lost civilization. There are bits and pieces and evidence all over the place, but the academic, you know, academia won't accept them at the moment. But this is why our geology panel is so important, because once we establish that the Sphinx is a hell of a lot older than anybody thinks, then suddenly the whole door opens, and all of a sudden everyone says, ah, ancient civilization, now they start looking, and then once that door is open, you know, the troops rush through.
And it's beginning to open really all
well,
over the world.
Well, we think so. This geo panel of ours is the battering ram we
feel.
Oh, and,
yes.
Of course, they may find, so, you know, we could be wrong.
But, John, off the coast of Cuba, amazing finds.
I know. I've heard about that.
India, all over
the
world. Okinawa, all over the world.
That's right.
It's all going to break open.
I think so. And just in time, too, because we need something to break things open to tell us that, you know, we're not as smart as we think that we are, and that actually great
and John,
spiritually based civilizations existed in the past.
In your virtual reality site, do you take people beyond the tombs and the pyramids to a place like NAFTA, where the oldest sort of Stonehenge-like rock circle has been found predating even Stonehenge, according to archaeologists?
Actually, not NAFTA, but that's on our plan for our geology panel, to get out there and look at the alignments there. But elsewhere, yes, the Red Pyramid that we were talking about before, everywhere. And in fact, on that virtual reality site, it's really, I mean, the technology is absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah.
There's just nothing like it.
I've been hearing a lot about NAFTA and other areas and things that are going on. That's why I asked you that question, John.
Yeah.
Because there are other things going on in Egypt.
NAFTA, yeah, but that's no secret. It's just hell to get to. It's way out by Abu Simbel and all the way out in the desert. So, you know, it's not It's not as though you can take a tourist bus out there.
Indeed.
But those rocks, and there is one of these big slabs in a photograph at earthfiles.com that is really eerie just looking at a photograph of one of these that are about 7,000 years old. And this is a circle of these stone, big, like 9 foot tall, and the scientists underscore that the rock was dragged from miles away to create that circle.
That's right. But those are relatively, you know, it's not as though they're Stonehenge-sized blocks, but still somebody had to bring them there. And actually, even that 4700 BC date, it's probably accurate as far as it goes, but the archaeoastronomer that we hope to bring with us has done, and this is, again, a man with impeccable credentials, has done work that suggests that the nature of the alignments may be suggesting, or let's say calling attention to, a still much earlier date. In other words, no argument that the site dates from when it does, but that it contains encoded in the way that it is aligned references to a still much earlier date.
That's one of the reasons
why we're so interested.
Yeah, you're thinking though of the Sphinx at 36,000 years. That's a gigantic jump, John.
Oh yeah,
gigantic.
Yes, I am. But as I said, it sounds wild, it does correspond to, let's say, hints within the Egyptian texts themselves, and just the nature of the Sphinx itself. I'll tell you a funny little anecdote. I can tell it now. Shock always never wanted me to tell it, but when he first got into the Sphinx enclosure, he stood there awed, as you do when you're in by the Sphinx, and looking around at this tremendously deeply weathered rock. He sort of looked around, and he's a geologist, so he sees rock where everyone else sees statue, and he said, "Wow," he said, "these rocks look like they're hundreds of thousands of years old." And then he turned to me and said, "Woof," he said, "don't quote me on that." And for years I didn't, but now, you know, the cat is out of the bag, and I don't mind saying it, but his informed intuition was that this thing was very, very old.
Listen, you two, we're out of time. Thank you both. Thank you so much. Linda, what an incredible report. And John, thank you.
And thank you, Art.
Good night to both of you. All right, there you have it, folks. Linda Moulton Howe, and you heard what they saw. And, of course, John Anthony West and Egypt.
I've been where the eagle flies, rode his wings across autumn skies, kissed the sun, touched the moon, but he left me much too soon. His lady bird, he left his lady bird. Lady bird, come on down, I'm here waiting on the ground. Lady bird, I'll treat you good. Ah, lady bird, I wish you would, you lady bird.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
In your wildest dreams, indeed. We're about to talk to a monster hunter. How's that for a job description, huh? Somebody who actually hunts monsters. Peter von Puttkamer, film director, joined the monster hunters on their quest to prove the existence of creatures science says aren't there, don't exist. He's been traveling through dark jungles and mountain caves around the world to document their journey. 2 years in the making, featuring six segments shot in England, Puerto Rico, Tasmania, Southern Australia, New Jersey, that's right, New Jersey, and British Columbia. There is a Jersey devil, you know. His documentary delves into the bizarre world of cryptozoology and the obsessed people who inhabit it. Obsessed. Peter von Puttkamer has been producing international award-winning films in the U.S. and Canada. Over the last 20 years, his documentaries have aired on Discovery Channel, TLC, Canada, U.S. and Europe, Global TV, CBC, CTV, SBS, everywhere it seems. These programs have won more than 50 international awards. Von Puttkamer has also directed short dramas and worked as a director of photography and editor on PBS documentaries. Programs have dealt with a variety of issues, anthropology, environment, socio-political themes of various sorts, medical breakthroughs, and films produced for and about Native Americans. His interest in the mythology and cultures of Native peoples led to a lifelong fascination with unknown mysteries, monsters, legendary animals, and of course the supernatural. His 1992 film, The Spirit of the Mask, provided an unprecedented look at the fantastic world of Northwest Coast Native masks and spiritual messages they contain for our world. Hosted by best-selling author Wade Davis, The Serpent and the Rainbow, the film featured rarely seen Native ceremonies. Sasquatch Odyssey came about through his interest in the wild man myths of the world. We know all about those, don't we? Discussions with producer Julie Lee about the life of Rene DeHinden and his 45-year search for Bigfoot. His most recent film, Monster Hunters, won the Platinum Award from the 35th Annual WorldFest Houston Festival in two categories, Best TV Documentary Series and Best TV Documentary Special. He is a monster hunter, and we've got eyewitness taped reports for you tonight. You're just not going to believe it. Stay right there. Well, all right. Here is Peter von Puttkamer, and I hope I'm doing that fairly well.
Good evening. It's great to be on the show, Art.
Good evening, Peter. Where are you?
I'm up in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Oh, that's a good place to be if you're going to hunt monsters anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a few of them up here.
Now, just out of general curiosity, Peter, how does a person get to be a monster hunter?
Well, you know, it's very flattering of you to call me a monster hunter, but I, as a filmmaker, I really consider myself a hunter of monster hunters because what we were really doing in our show was featuring people that, you know, have spent many, many years chasing after these elusive creatures, and there seems to be no limit to number of ways you can chase a monster and the approaches you can take, and you know, people are coming from all walks of life doing this.
So you decided, okay then, I'll get with what seems to be a productive monster hunting group and bring the camera along, something like that?
Well, actually, I can tell you a little bit about, like for me, how this started, like how I got off on this whole tangent with monsters, because my work had been in wildlife photography, wildlife filmmaking and working with Native Americans, ethnographic films and so on, and we got into doing a film called Sasquatch Odyssey, The Hunt for Bigfoot, just two or three years ago, and we had a chance to follow the life of Rene DeHinden and Peter Byrne and John Green and Dr. Grover Krantz, mm-hmm. who just passed away, and that became a profile of these men that had spent more than 40 years searching for a creature, you know, that the rest of the world isn't too sure about. And that just, to me, it just opened up a whole world of amazing stories and just the determination of these people to go after something, and with, you know, very little evidence, but with some very, very compelling eyewitness reports.
All right, we're going to be talking about things like the Jersey Devil and chupacabras. Boy, did we deal with that on this show, Tasmanian Tiger,
yeah,
that sort of thing. We really have done a lot on this program about all of this, but like everybody else,
yeah,
Peter, we haven't pinned it down. I mean, we don't have a captured chupacabra or Jersey Devil to put on display or anything like that, and yet, I guess I would ask, in all of your research, before we even get into all of these cuts we have here,
yes,
are you convinced that this is not just myth and legend?
Are you just referring to those two creatures?
No.
In general?
No. Throw in Bigfoot.
Okay.
In everything you want.
Well, I've made up my own little list of creatures from greater credibility to lesser, and that's not to take away from things like the Jersey Devil. You know, any time you have a story of a creature that is born the cursed 13th child of a woman who might have consorted with the devil, your credibility gets stretched a little bit. But I mean, certainly things like the Cadbosaurus, which is, I hope we're going to get into a discussion on that, because I think it's, in my mind, the most credible of all of the sea monsters or even lake monsters that I've ever encountered or read about.
Well, I'm seeing an awful lot of press lately on large sea monsters, actually, and they've got some pictures of just bigger than we ever could believe even existed sea creatures. I mean, gigantic things.
I think that there's a lot of credibility. I mean, I came away from this basically, I guess, with about an 80% ratio of believability, in which I thought, you know, there really is something going on here that, you know, you can't just explain away as mass hysteria or a hoax, because there's too many incidents for these things to be hoaxed again and again. And in the case of a chupacabra, I mean, we were down there with a group of paranormal experts, Beyond Boundaries, Joyce Murphy and her group, and also Bob Buck. And basically what we were doing was, you know, tracking down these stories and seeing how credible they were.
Right.
And they were also using some remote viewers to get to places where people hadn't really looked before, and one of them was the Arecibo Space Telescope. So that was, that was pretty fantastic, you know. I mean, we were really, really out there on the edges of the paranormal.
Okay, well, that is my big question, and that is,
yeah,
how much of this do you put in the category of paranormal? I mean, a lot,
yeah,
of people, after all, think that Bigfoot is a leftover. Bigfoot actually lives here and simply hides effectively, and same with a lot of other creatures, versus the paranormal, that they blink in and they blink out, might be from another dimension. I mean, who knows? Where do you put the weight there?
Well, if you were one of the, in the show I did on Bigfoot, that was a big debate. I mean, you had this group of, as they're referred to, the four horsemen of Sasquatchery, the guys that had been out there in the bush pounding the beat, mm-hmm, looking for the physical evidence. And then you had a school of people that were believing in, you know, interdimensional travel, beaming down from UFOs and this sort of thing. And definitely there was a big divide there. I think there's just way too much evidence globally for this wild man myth to be entire, you know, something, a figment of people's imagination, because, you know, even in Europe,
Okay, let's again nail down what we're talking about. You said a figment of people's imagination. Now, by that, are you saying that is a paranormal, if you're putting it off to a figment of their imagination? Or
I just think,
are you saying the wild man thing is real and they're really here and really living here and really hiding and we just don't see them very often?
Yeah, I believe that they, I mean, my own philosophy on this now, and having talked to, you know, all of these old-timers about it, and also the eyewitness reports, is that I believe that Bigfoot may have indeed existed here as it existed on many continents, but isn't necessarily here anymore. But I do think there's been an impact through the, you know, deforestation and industry and what have you. And I think if there's any still around, they've headed for the hills, you know, which I think there used to be a lot more reports on them than there are now, although, you know, they still continue to come in.
And yet, for example, in a relatively urban area like New Jersey, we've still got the Jersey Devil. Can we play one of those segments?
Sure. Can I do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of just do it as we go. In New Jersey, of all places, what is it we're about to hear?
You know what? I'm not entirely sure, but I suspect it's one of the hunts.
All right, I've got three apparent tracks that relate to the Jersey Devil. Let's see what we've got here.
Okay.
Here we go.
I seen this thing going across the top of the bushes, and the only way I can describe it is that it was like the mobile horse, the sign of the mobile horse.
Yeah, it sounded like a woman screaming, but real loud. If you can picture amplification, you know, loudest scream you ever heard, maybe 10 times more or even 15 times more, where it would wake you up out of a dead sleep. And it would just scream bloody murder, and I'm telling you, you had to hear it to believe actually how loud it would be.
All right, that's the first cut, and that's about the Jersey Devil. And this one, too, Laura Luter, I believe it is, followed by a couple of authors on the Jersey Devil.
There's just the immense curiosity that builds up behind this legend. How can it be a hoax when all of this stuff has happened? How could all of these people have seen it? Is it really the 13th child? Is it a biological creature we haven't found yet? What is it?
The Jersey Devil has been called the official state demon of the state of New Jersey.
All states have state birds, butterflies, fish, but New Jersey's the only one with a demon.
The Jersey Devil has a number of forms. Quite a few monsters just have maybe one form that they're known for. But the Jersey Devil has been anything from a demonic type of shape, one of its most common features, kind of gargoyle looking, with a horse-like head, bat wings. Put that all together, it makes it a kind of a different, unexplained monster.
And then finally, on the scream of the Jersey Devil.
You got it, Sean?
Yeah. We all in?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, let's keep going.
Come on, Laura, you hear something?
Yeah, I do.
We've come across the Jersey Devil screech a couple times collectively, the people in the group. And it sounded like machinery and a woman and an animal all combined. It sent chills up my spine. Stay as quiet as possible. It sounded exactly like what I've ever heard described.
I hear that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I heard that very, very, very clearly, actually. Now, there was Jersey. You know, they said that it possibly demonic in nature. Mm-hmm. That kind of follows the Jersey Devil, what people say about it, because I don't rule anything out, and one of the possibilities is that there is something demonic. I mean, you just simply can't rule it out. You've got God and the Bible and the fact that, you know, they surely say there are these demons, then a lot of people would believe it could be so. It could be demonic, couldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is an incredible creature and phenomenon. I think more should be written and done, you know, to let people know about it, because it's, for one thing, it's a great American legend. It's really as big a phenomenon as Bigfoot, and just hasn't gotten the press.
Yeah, but Peter, if this thing really was or is demonic,
yes,
would you want to really encounter it?
I mean, it was actually very scary to be out there. It was actually, of all the places we went to in the world, New Jersey was the scariest. Where we were in that forest, and you got a picture, like every few hundred yards, I mean, you're out in the forest. It's very noisy in there, as you could hear.
Yes.
And we're traveling with this group. I mean, we really did go on these hunts with them. I mean, you know, we went out into the night. They got lost at one point. It was just like the Blair Witch kind of experience. And it was creepy. And the thing about it is there's tombstones every few hundred yards. There's these family plots.
Yes.
They have family plots in this neck of the woods down there. And they're like from the 1700s and 1800s. So there's old graves everywhere as you're walking through these woods.
Well, you know, encountering something that's been here for a long time, that's one thing. Encountering even a ghost or something of that nature is bad enough. But encountering something that's actually demonic, boy, I'd be going the other way so fast, Peter. You know, hearing those sounds, the demonic part, I wouldn't want to have anything to do with it.
Well, I can tell you a little bit more about those first two eyewitness things that we heard.
Please do.
Because it's very interesting. These people, they're called the Pineys, and it's actually become a bit of a derogatory term now, but it used to be the way they were referred to, and they're people that live in the Pine Barrens. Mm. A lot of folks don't know that southern New Jersey is actually kind of a pristine wilderness. There's an area the size of Delaware down there that's all these Pine Barrens and dunes and swamps, and it's very desolate, and, you know, there could possibly be a species of animal in there that you wouldn't know about.
Oh, Peter, they could be all across the country. Listen, we tend to live, you know, kind of in cities, but if you plan a road trip, which you ought to do, because traveling overseas these days isn't much fun anyway, and you travel across the United States, you will realize very, very quickly that for all we are, 300 million of us, my God, there's a lot of barren territory out there and forested territory, and it just virtually untouched.
Yes. Well, these Pineys, I agree totally. I think there's lots of places for creatures to hide and dark corners for them to live in. And this place, the Pine Barrens, is certainly one. And those two people we heard, it's a family named the Higginbothams, and they've been there since the 1940s. The first person we heard was the mom, and this is one of the only actual modern-day sightings, I think. It's a very clear daylight sighting of the Jersey Devil. And, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people. You want to talk about credibility, right?
Yes.
I mean, this lady told this story, you know, without any great embellishment. I mean, it was like, matter of fact, yeah, this is what I saw,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't a vulture. She said, I know what vultures look like. This thing had a horse-like head, and it had this fur on it, and it was very, very strange, and she could only describe it looking like the mobile horse, or like a flying horse, like a Pegasus.
Right here on Earth right now. All right, hold on, Peter. I'm Art Bell, and we have with us a monster hunter camera person. Maybe that would be better. We've got a whole lot of cuts for you on these things that science says aren't there, but I think most of us know they certainly are there in one form or another, one dimension or another. We'll be right back.
To
Richard Bell in the Kingdom of Nye. From west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
It is indeed. Good morning, everybody. Peter von Hookhammer is here. He's a monster hunter, really. He does it with a camera. He gets together with people who hunts these, who hunt these things. They're like the Jersey Devil and so much more if you'll just stay right where you are. I should know better. I lived in parts of New Jersey. I lived in Newark, New Jersey. I lived in the urban areas of New Jersey, and so I never really thought about it that much. But Bob in Allentown, Pennsylvania, Rob, rather, points out, hey, Art, except for Newark and Camden, it's not the urban jungle, you might imagine. New Jersey, of course, is much of it's forested, and a good deal of the area is known as the Pine Barrens coming inland from the shore, and that's exactly where we were with Peter. Peter?
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just referring back to the those first two cuts, we heard the folks that live in the Pine Barrens, and the second eyewitness, Randy Higginbotham. I mean, they've had more than one encounter with this sound, and he actually said to me the first time was that it sounded like a woman being torn apart, is what he said. It sounded like someone being murdered out in the swamps. And it was so loud, he said, it shook the walls of the house. It was they ran out with their guns. And this happened, after night, over a period of at least 2 years.
Now, you see, that's what I'd do. I'd get a gun and I'd run out. If I heard something like that, you're damn right I'd have a gun. That's the normal reaction.
But it's so odd. I mean, it's like if it happens once, you go, okay, well, you know, maybe somebody was drunk or screaming or something. But for it to happen, and it's totally unpopulated, like this area he's referring to, there's nobody that lives back in there. It's just a swamp. And what could have been causing that? And at the sound, you know, the sound levels, just even to produce that, what is actually making that sound? It's pretty weird.
I don't know. But you gave us one description. I mean, what is the Jersey Devil known to have done? Is it actually ever known to have done anything, as in...
Yes, very much so. Going back to the original legend, and there's a lot of different variations on this story, you know, things started during the Revolutionary Wars, and, I mean, the most popular legend is there was a lady... Mother Leeds. Now, the Leeds family was a wealthy family in that area, had 12 children, was, you know, burdened with, you know, too many kids to take care of or what have you, and declared, let this next child be a devil. And this baby was born. Apparently, first it looked normal, and then it transformed into a demon in front of them. And in one of the more popular accounts, actually... killed a whole bunch of people, like ate the parents, and then flew out the window.
Oh my God!
And that's one of the more demonic stories about it. And
the only trouble I have with that is that if there's a paranormal aspect to these creatures, how could they eat people in this dimension where they can barely just appear? Scaring the hell out of us, but I mean that would imply that this is some real creature, not some paranormal phenomenon.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we're talking about a flesh and blood demon here, and I mean the fact that you've got a hero of the Revolutionary War, Commodore Decatur, you know, at a firing range testing. Cannon shells for his war against the Barbary pirates, and he sees the Jersey Devil go by and fires into it, and some of the grape shot goes through the wing of the Jersey Devil, and it keeps flying.
Oh, that's strange.
Very odd story.
Very odd. Then we've got, we're going to jump to the United Kingdom here. And I get, I can't tell you, I do this program, and so we talk about this sort of thing all the time, this kind of phenomena. And I have policemen calling me all the time. Policemen encounter these things, and they, of course, they make superb witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're cops. I mean, they're trained to notice things, even under stress. They're trained to still notice things. Take their, you know, they have their brain working a different way than ours, and it's trained to notice things.
Yeah.
And you've got this interview or something coming up with this police constable.
Yes. Well, what was interesting over there is the sightings of phantom big cats, leopards, and pumas and cougars in the British countryside is now so common that. The police barely even bother going out when they hear about it because, oh, just another panther on the prowl, you know. And we had our pick of policemen. Like, they all had personal encounters with it.
Yes.
They all knew they existed. The RSPCA know they're there. But here's the mystery part. No bodies have shown up, no dead creatures on the highway, and the government has not officially acknowledged the presence of these animals in the country.
So, in other words, hence the name Phantom, huh?
Yes.
Okay. Here's a police officer in the United Kingdom whose name is Police Constable Dave Toon.
When I lowered the binoculars and turned to my right, about 10 yards to my right was this big black cat. And I could see that it was about the size of a small fox, certainly 2 to 3 times bigger than a household cat. It turned, looked at me, and then ran off. But as it ran in a loping sort of movement, keeping its head very, very still and very low to the ground, which again is reminiscent of large black cats such as panthers and that type of animal.
All right, so there you have a police officer down in the United Kingdom. Very interesting. And then there's, I guess, there is not. That was the same cut. I see. Okay, so we're going to move from there to chupacabras in a second. But these phantom cats, do they, so they disappear? They just poof?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm in touch with some of the monster hunters we worked with over there. Quentin Rhodes, who is an actual animal, very unusual. I mean, this man learned his trapping techniques from the Cree and Chippewa Indians in northern Canada. He's very, very British. He's like a small Welshman. He's out there with a leopard trap. He's the only person in England licensed to carry a leopard trap that will actually trap live leopards in the United Kingdom. So you'll see him in sight of, you know, sort of 16th century castle setting up a leopard trap. It's a very odd thing. Other people like the Spencers, who run something called the Leicestershire Rutland Panther Watch, and they get a sighting about once a week. It's very common.
This brings us to something that I've discussed extensively on the show, and boy, have we batted this back around and around and around and around, the whole chupacabra thing. We went through a sort of a period of time. It seemed to last, the better part of a year, I think. And we began to get these reports from Puerto Rico, and then later from South America, then from Mexico, and then from the Southwest United States, of this really awful creature called a chupacabra, and it was killing animals and sucking their blood. And I've got Linda Moulton Howe who reported on that. She took a trip down to Puerto Rico to report on these things. And whatever in God's name, maybe I shouldn't use that phrase, whatever in whoever's name whatever these things are, they're real. They really did do the things described. I mean, we had veterinarians report to us on these two marks and all the blood drawn out of animals and stuff like that. So what do you know about chupacabras?
Well, one thing that I guess my background in working with Native Indians and ethnography and so on, that one thing I uncovered that I'd never read anywhere in any of the Chupacabra literature was, because I was fascinated in the whole phenomenon, the Taino Indians, who are the ancient people that lived in Puerto Rico before the Spanish came there, the people whose mountain was actually, they traveled there to get closer to the gods. That's why they went to El Yunque. It's the highest point in the whole that area of the Caribbean. And so they lived there, and they had legends about, you know, demons and creatures of the night, but they specifically had a legend about something they called the Mosquito Man. And I found this legend, and the Mosquito Man would travel at night into villages and drill these two small holes into the necks of their victims. Draining them of blood. And so, you know, it got me thinking, okay, there must be some connection to the Chupacabra myth here, or Chupacabra phenomenon. And it's very, very interesting to me. Of course, we, in a number of eyewitnesses, you know, we went out and met people, and I also viewed a lot of existing film footage that was done, and, you know, people are truly frightened. By this, it's you know, doesn't appear to be any kind of hoax to me.
I've heard these creatures can travel 60, 70 miles an hour, really, really fast. Have you heard that as part of this?
Yeah, I mean, we heard variations. There was a lady who described one hovering by her window. It actually moved. I mean, there's everything from jumping like a kangaroo to, you know, it's hovering. You know, the glowing eyes and just tremendous strength, so much so that, you know, there's a well-known account now of a 1,500-pound bull being taken down.
Yeah, wouldn't these be, why wouldn't they be classified as vampires? I mean, if they put two holes in the neck and they draw out all the blood, that sure sounds a lot like a vampire to me.
Well, amongst our group, Beyond Boundaries group that was down there, I mean, there are a lot of different theories, and one of them was that, you know, it was some kind of alien pet. Alien pet, because there were sightings of UFOs and then chupacabras. You know, it's a genetic experiment. Military, there's so many military secret bases in Puerto Rico, and including one right at the very, very top of El Yunque, the Taino Indians' legendary mountain, that, you know, it sits right in the rainforest, right where this thing is supposed to exist. And it gets you thinking, you know, is this some kind of government genetic experiment gone wrong? And that's what one of our monster hunters believes.
All right, would that be Bob Buck?
Yes.
All right, let's play that segment. Here is, on the Chupacabra, here is Bob Buck.
Not an animal I think you'd really want to upset. Anything can kill a healthy 1,500-pound bull, run it down and kill it. I don't think most people would really want to come face-to-face with it.
And one night we can hear rattling noises. Cages were bent in. Some of them, just the wounds were in the neck, the ones that were laying on the floor. But the ones that were still in their cages, it seems like whatever it was pulling the rabbit's out of the cages.
All right, and here's one more eyewitness.
I personally do not believe or disbelieve on the Chupacabra. I take it that the people that see these witnesses aren't lying, aren't crazy, aren't drunk, and that, well, illusions don't kill animals. It's definitely a creature. And once you determine that, then you look at the evidence to try to determine what this creature may be.
Okay. Let's move back one more time to the actual eyewitness account.
And one night, we can hear rattling noises. Cages were bent in. Some of them, just the wounds were in the neck, the ones that were laying on the floor. But the ones that were still in their cages, it seems like whatever it was pulling the rabbit's teeth out of the cages.
Yeah. That goes along with all these reports we had. I mean, we had veterinarians on the job examining these creatures, and this is not somebody's imagination. Something was definitely poking two holes in the neck, and by the way, I might add, a very weird way, and drawing every bit of blood out.
And then there's this other thing, this weird thing about this chupacabras, and that's that it's kind of like it came, it traveled, it killed, and then it went away. Mm-hmm. It went away. And who knows if it's going to be back, but we haven't had reports now for a while, or are you getting reports?
I haven't had any brand new reports on this, but it seems like these things kind of come and go in you know, different stretches of time. The reports come in. But one thing was interesting is we had a chance to talk to the mayor of the town that actually built a steel cage and had 200 of his civil defense troops, you know, out there trying to trap one of these.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And what did he say?
Well, he's one of the only government officials down there who's actually come forward, and he's basically just trying to make his area safe for his people. And there were, the head of his security team there, he's talked to a lot of people. He's been out on, you know, he's packing a rifle out there when he goes out there, and he's convinced that, you know, there's something real out there. But they were tying goats to trees, and they had this cage, and they were serious about trying to actually capture this, but, you know, they didn't get it.
What do you think would happen, Peter, if one of these things were caught? What do you think would happen? I mean, right now you can go to a circus or a sideshow and you can see things for, you know, a buck and a quarter or whatever it is that just seem impossible. Would the world believe what it saw, or, you know, would somehow all of it just get masked over and it would be some sort of aberration? Or, you know, the people who would have to examine something like this wouldn't want to see something that wouldn't fit their little tight little paradigms.
Well, I think you're right. I think nowadays, more than ever, unfortunately, the world, it's gotten much tougher for monster hunters to prove the existence of things, because with the digital photography and Photoshop and all those sorts of things,
everything can be faked.
Everything can be faked, and I think that's what science is waiting for, is some kind of body that can be examined. I'm not sure why more hasn't been made of this veterinarian, Carlos Soto, who we got some tape of as well. He's very, very clear about, he's examining animals, and he's talking about a tube-like device that is being inserted into the internal organs of the animals, because he's finding spaghetti-like holes all the way through the bodies of these animals.
Yes.
He's a trained medical. He was trained in the United States. You know, he knows what he's looking at, and I'm not sure why that hasn't been followed up a bit more.
Well, maybe because, as a society, we kind of like believing in monsters to scare ourselves, but I'm not sure that we want hard evidence of monsters. Then you go from scary to, hey, this is really scary, you know, really, really scary. It's real. It's not a myth. It's not a sit around the fire telling a ghost story kind of deal. It's real.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, that's one of the things that drew me to these projects is just people's need to have monsters in our midst. Why do we need a wild man? Why do we need this hairy other out there? Why do we need blood-sucking alien vampires?
Because we like to be scared.
Yeah.
But I don't think we like to really understand. Here is a veterinarian been examining these carcasses. And by the way, the chupacabra was said to attack. There were several eyewitnesses, for example, in Mexico, in attacks of human beings, and they told some pretty awful stories. And we've, you know, while we don't have photographs, we've got drawings of the chupacabra, and it's a horrible, horrible creature that moves very, very fast.
Well, we actually, I wasn't too satisfied with any of the depictions I had seen sketches or anything else, because most of them were hastily drawn eyewitness sketches, and while we didn't exactly have a Hollywood budget on this film, we did manage to get one of the people who work on major television series, science fiction series, to construct a chupacabra for us and what it
based on all of the eyewitnesses.
Based on all of the eyewitness.
All right, hold that thought. We're at the top of the hour. Hold that thought, and we'll be right back. I'm Art Bell, and we have with us tonight a monster hunter, Peter von Kummer. Stay right where you are.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
It absolutely is. Hello there, everybody. If you want to see something that'll make your blood run cold, maybe we'll get it up here shortly on the website, just in case you've never seen it. We did a show on the Mothman while we're on the subject of monsters. And the Mothman photographs that we had, or depictions, well, there was somebody who took a picture of the 9-1-1 disaster. And flying adjacent to, or behind, one of the large skyscraper buildings is this incredible thing. My God, it'll make your blood run absolutely cold. If I can get a hold of Keith, and I'm trying to get the photograph up there under What's New, we will. But the person who took the photograph also then later supplied a blow-up. I hope Keith has that version, a blow-up of this creature. And there's no question it's a pterodactyl of some sort. But you look at that, and it flew right as the whole 9-1-1 thing was occurring. You see that photograph, and I to me, it makes my blood run cold to see that. And we'll try and get it up there if I can get a hold of Keith. Stay right where you are. My guest, who is a monster hunter, Peter von Puttkummer, will be right back. All right, back to our friend, the monster hunter, Peter. Actually, he's not a monster hunter. I keep saying that, but in a way you are.
Sure.
In a way you are, so it's kind of fair.
I'll take that title, sure.
Any idea of where the chupacabra originated? Do you believe it's actually from Puerto Rico, was sprouted or cooked up in Puerto Rico or in some other dimension?
Well, there's a lot of theories on that, of course, but I think Puerto Rico is a unique environment for creating such a creature as the chupacabra, because you have these Taino Indian legends, you have the secret, government bases there, you know, you have a rainforest. It's an island.
So let's think about this. If it was a military base and a military experiment, then if it got loose, they wouldn't need much of a cover story, would they? In other words, it's just something that came out of the forest.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, we did talk. You know, we talked to the people at Arecibo, and we talked to the people at in the national parks. You know, and of course they're very adamant of there not being such a creature there.
Oh, I'm sure they are. Yes. Seth Shostak, who's down at Arecibo frequently, would be the first to tell you what a bunch of bunk.
Yeah.
You know, he heads up the SETI project, and he takes a lot of flack himself, but he doesn't believe in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists don't.
Well, it does make you think when you're at that Arecibo, you think of them sending signals to outer space for all these, 40 to 50 years, where would a craft or where would an alien, head in on? They'd head in on a beam coming from that location. I mean, it's been sending signals out for decades.
No, actually, that's not true. Arecibo sent one extremely strong short burst into space. This might interest you.
Mm-hmm.
And then and that was many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And then scientists here and in Canada both lobbied to stop it because they said, what you're doing here is serious, and it may well be that you're going to send a signal out, something this strong, and it really is going to be received, and we're going to have some visitors that we wouldn't like, and based on that psychology, they stopped sending signals. Arecibo now only receives. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
But that one signal did go blasting out there, so yeah, something might have homed in on it, and so, sure, the chupacabra originating from that point might make some sense.
Mm-hmm.
There you are, Peter. All right, what do we know about Cadbrosaurus, is it?
Yes.
Well, what is that?
Well, this is a great monster.
A great monster.
This is a great monster. This is one I am quite certain exists. I think there's really something going on here. For one thing, if you haven't seen the photograph, we've got one on our website, monsterhunters.com, but it's basically, I think, the best cryptozoological image that I've ever seen, short of maybe that famous Patterson film from the Sasquatch days back in 1967. I mean, this is better than any image that was ever taken of Loch Ness or any other lake monster. There's a picture of a juvenile version of one of these creatures that's been pulled from the belly of a sperm whale, and it was propped up on the dock, and it was taken by a first aid officer. This is at a whaling station in northern British Columbia in 1937, and these pictures were taken of it.
All right, listen, I'm trying to get on your website right now. It's jammed up, unfortunately, because we're talking about it. So can you describe what's in this photo? I'll eventually get to it, but for us right now that can't see it.
Sure, I'll tell you what it is. I'll describe it briefly, and then I'll give you a little background on this creature. So what it is essentially is a snake-like creature with clear humps and a camel-like head and a tail that's quite detailed, and it's, if you can actually blow this up and you can see a kind of an articulated, almost hand, almost like a lobster tail or something coming around on it. And it's about sort of 12 to 14 feet long. We actually interviewed in the show 86-year-old dock worker who was there when they pulled this thing out. And he was a real no-nonsense guy, and he just said, we saw lots of things come out of whale stomachs, but we never saw anything like this. That's why we took the time. We were busy people, but we took the time to set this thing up. They put white sheets in behind it so you could see its color. It would stand out against the gray wood of the dock, and they took several pictures of it, and it's very clear. And, you know, we showed this to scientists, and, you know, they, most people cannot conjecture as to what this thing might be. But there's a whole history of actually what happened to the body and what the scientists at the time said and all of that.
Oh, I'd like to know. First of all, I'm getting on your site. Where would I go?
Under Monster Profiles.
Monster Profile, okay.
And then Cadbosaurus. And then you just click once and leave the mouse cursor on there. It's a little awkward, but it stays up, and you should be able to see the picture of this creature. But I'll tell you in the meantime that, you know, this creature has been sighted for centuries by Native Indians. It's integral. This is what makes it better to me than Loch Ness, is that you've got you know, Native Indian people that I've talked to who've seen it to this day, but it's an integral part of their culture. I mean, it's on drums, it's on their whaling canoes, and it fits the description. Like, their image of it fits the eyewitness descriptions that happened much, much later of what people actually saw, with a horse or camel-like head, a kind of a mane, and these humps. And this animal has been described as being anywhere from 25 feet to 80, 90, 100 feet in length.
Ay, ay, ay.
And
your page is really loading very slowly. I'm coming up on it. I see a horse head sort of alternating with something else. So we'll get to it eventually. I always murder websites when I talk about stuff like this.
Okay. Well, you just go to Monster Profiles, and then you click on Chupacabra, and then you have to go to the image, and I think it's the middle button. You just click and hold on that, and this picture should come up. But in any case, what else can I tell you about?
Well, how about we play the we've got eyewitness stuff here. Terry Osland?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
Don
I'll tell you a lot.
Okay, all right. Well, then here's a witness to it.
The Cabrasaurus, or the serpent, was about 20 feet probably from the beach. It was like going back thousands of years and actually seeing something prehistoric.
We proceeded to land, and we landed beside this log that moved. We then realized that it was the Cabrasaurus.
There was this huge neck and head came out of the water, and about 15 feet maybe behind that, there was the first big curve of a body with fins, and about another 15 feet behind that was the second fin.
Second thing. And then here's yet one other.
There's got to be some reason this animal comes into this part of the world. The sea serpents and these mysterious animals are sighted all over the place, all over the world in every sea. But this animal is sighted every year, and we just have to think that it's here for some purpose, whether that's reproductive reasons. And if it wasn't for the fact that you have hundreds of people seeing exactly the same thing, there probably wouldn't be a point to all this. But it's the one thing that drives us all on.
There you are. So there you are, a one who saw this incredible thing, and I guess we have these things at depths in the sea, and we don't normally see them, but every now and then there they are.
Well, there's an area in near Victoria on Vancouver Island, so this is British Columbia, and it's called a place called Deep Cove, and this is where the most frequent sightings happen. And this one person you heard was actually a commercial pilot, and we actually went up with him and surveyed the area, and we went with one of the scientists. And there are, in fact, two scientists, former head of oceanography, University of British Columbia, Paul LeBlond, and a biologist, Dr. Ed Bousfield from back east. And the two of them have been trying to get this classified as a legitimate creature for 30 years.
I know there have also been a lot of sonar reports of creatures of this sort, haven't there?
Yes. I'm not too sure about the Cadbosaurus, but I think there are other accounts like that, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm just not having any luck. Everybody's hitting the website as we're talking about it, so I'm just... We murder one website after another after
another. Oh, well, that's okay. But this business of having an actual creature be pulled from the belly of a whale is pretty incredible.
All right, what happened to it? I mean, you said there were stories about what actually happened to the creature, what the scientists did. What did they do? What?
Well, this, of course, is what makes this a great mystery monster hunt, is that, what I understand is that the company, the shipping company, whaling station, basically put this thing on a bit of a roadshow.
Right.
And they preserved it in, I think it was acetone or some kind of alcohol, and they sent it down. I think it got as far south as Bellevue, Washington, and then the head disappeared.
What?
The head disappeared.
you mean just disappeared?
Well, I mean someone walked off with the head. And to this day, I mean, you know, we're speculating there's a, you know, sea serpent skull gathering dust on someone's bottom basement drawer. But the body was then taken to the Royal British Columbia Museum.
Yes.
And the curator at the time, a fellow named Francis Kermode, who was actually a taxidermist by trade and not a trained zoologist or anything, he looked at it and declared that it was a fetal baleen whale, like a, you know, very young juvenile-type baleen whale.
Mm.
But it actually doesn't look anything like that, and it doesn't look like a rotting basking shark or any of these other famous explanations of, you know, in the past people have found, you know, lumps on the beach, or they found things that looked like sea serpents, and they proved to be like a rotting basking shark carcass. You know, as it rots away, you end up with a spine, a little head, and these fins that jut out, so it looks like a sea serpent. But
reports of sea serpents have been around as long as men have been plying the seas.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Very, very serious stories. I mean, seen again and again and again and again. So, and now in modern times, we're even seeing more of them, of these monster-like things in the very deep.
Well, let me just tell you another thing about this creature. That there was a series of coincidental things that happened on this that were quite remarkable for me. Now, we interviewed this lady, that Terry Osland, who you heard first. Her encounter with this creature, she was walking her dog, and she came down to the beach, and this animal was on the beach, 30 to 40 feet long. The neck was up 15 feet in the air, staring at her. And, you know, and so you kind of go, oh, yeah, well, gee, that sounds pretty fantastic. But then I'm up on a different project, actually. I'm in a native community in northern British Columbia, and I'm talking to these people, and I said to them, these are native Indian women, and I asked them about this island that's just off of their reservation there, and they said, well, that's a special place. That's where our young people went for initiation. So we've left that alone. We don't touch that at all. It's all forested, and we've left it. And they said the other thing that was special, that's the place where the serpent used to come out of the water onto the beach. And if you were a young person on a vision quest and you saw that you had brought you great luck in your life. But this was described as the place where the serpent came up on the beach.
Well, yeah, but these descriptions, for example, of the long neck, that sounds like Nessie.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? I mean, there have been pictures of Nessie, and we've all seen that long neck coming up out of the water. Sounds just like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the one thing that we talked to, you know, a well-respected scientist and about this whole phenomenon, and he was actually pretty open-minded about it. I mean, he said for him, the deep ocean is, you know, uncharted territory, and he is open to the idea of there being these types of creatures there. And a friend of his, he told us kind of off the record, I guess, but he said that a friend of his who is also, you know, whose opinion he respects as a trained scientist and so on, did see a wake moving at about 20 knots through Deep Cove one day, and it just, you know, totally confused him. He couldn't figure out what it was. It wasn't a whale. It wasn't a seal, and it was very, very odd. So he had an open mind. So I think that
that's different.
There's something to this.
That's different for a scientist. All right, Peter, hold on. We're talking with a monster hunter. I guess we've agreed on that much. Peter von Bookhammer is my guest. And you've seen pictures of Nessie, I'm sure, right? Do you know that we actually know a lot less about what's at the very deepest part of our oceans than we know about near-Earth space, which we inhabit on a regular basis? We don't inhabit the depths on a regular basis. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
Certainly is. Good morning, everybody. All right, we've got it up there right now. If you go to tonight's guest on my website, artbell.com, tonight's guest, and you'll look down for Peter's name, and then down below that, you'll see related image that Keith just got up. World Trade Center, Angel Bird or what? I want you to click on that and look at it a bit. It'll cause your blood to run cold. Now, we have to thank somebody out there for this. Stephen Moran, who apparently is copyrighted, has a picture and provided it for us, including a close-up. And holy moly, if this doesn't... I don't care where you think that thing is, close in or far out, it's a pterodactyl. This is some kind of monster and was there during the World Trade Center attack. You go take a look for yourself on my website, artbell.com, right now. Peter's looking as we speak. Once again, to me, this is a monster, and I don't know what else you'd call it. Something prehistoric, something paranormal, maybe. I don't know, but it's an extremely clear shot. Peter, were you able to bring that up on your computer?
I was, yes. I've had a look at it.
What do you think of that?
Now, it's pretty remarkable. It's definitely not a fuzzy image. It's very clear, even in the blow-up. It holds up very well.
The blow-up is what... We got this very recently, and the blow-up just, excuse the expression, blew my mind. I know of no animal on Earth that has that shape of wing. Do you?
No, it's definitely odd. I mean, I'd like to see it, you know, I'd like to see some kind of scrutiny of it a little bit. Like, I'd like to know, you know, where it was taken and you know, what the circumstances were and you know, what an expert thought about it, I guess, you know. Just in terms of photographically, and
they definitely weren't after that. They were obviously after the, you know, the pictures of the devastation going on. I mean, that's what
yes,
photography was all about then. But
yeah, where is that actually taken?
I don't have the whole story behind it, but I know it was one, I think it was some sort of professional photograph taken during the 911 disaster, and this just showed up on it, and I don't know what to make of it, but it shouldn't be there. Now, obviously, as you point out, we live in a time when people can do probably almost anything, but you know, people will argue, well, you know, okay, well, this thing isn't that really big. It's closer to the camera than you think. Even if that's true, with the blow up, you know, that's pretty historic to me. How about you?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a bizarre, I mean, it's something very bizarre. It does not, it's not definitely not a plane, and it's not any bird that, you know,
that we know of.
So, you know, it's hard to say just on first.
And of course, if it's behind that building, as it actually would appear to be in the photograph, it's monstrous.
Hmm.
Anyway, onward. We've got what you call, or what is called, Yowie.
Yes.
Yowie. What's Yowie?
Oh yeah, Yowie. Yowie's another great creature. What we tried to do in this show, when I looked at, you know, we sort of did this definitive Bigfoot documentary, and I wanted to deal in one of these episodes with a wild man, and one that maybe isn't as well known in America, certainly quite well known in Australia. And there's a group over there, Australian Hominid Research, a fellow named Dean Harrison heads it up, and they are very, very serious monster hunters. They go out with a whole load of tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Mm-hmm. They're not unlike the SciFactor team. They go out and they actually do surveillance around homes. They set up trip wires, infrared, cameras hidden in logs. I mean, you can't believe the degree of you know, detail these guys go to try and capture this thing and on camera. Now, what we're talking about is a Bigfoot-like creature in Australia, one that's been recorded again in Aboriginal stories, but it seems to be quite a bit meaner than our one over here. And if you hear Dean does talk on the clip about its preferred killing method, it's just it's nocturnal, and all the hunts are conducted at night with minimal, almost virtually no lighting, actually, at all. It was a real challenge for us to tag along on that one. They actually, monster hunters communicate through tiny sapphire lights, sort of, you know, button-sized lights on their lapels.
Oh,
they
really?
Flash at each other.
Really?
Yep.
All right, we're going to hear from Dean Harrison now, and we're going to follow that with Neil Black, a school teacher who actually saw this Yowie creature. So, first, Dean Harrison. Here's Dean.
The favorite means of death of animals by the Yowie: decapitation, a quick break of the neck, and bodily dismemberment. All of those things don't sit very well with me.
I was told we have kangaroos, wallabies, wombats, everything, but what I heard behind that bush is something I have never heard, and nor could I describe that roar to anybody. It was so menacing, so savage, and it was directed at me. It made the hair on my neck literally stand up. I break out into goose pimples every time I think about it.
All right, now we've got a school teacher who actually saw what he's just talking about.
The Yowie stood up directly in front of me. It was about 6 foot. It was standing outside. It reached across through the bush at me and roared in my face. It then took off through the bush at rather high speed, pushing everything out of its road like a mechanical backhoe, I suppose the best way to describe it. It's pushed everything out of the road and roared as it went.
All right. There you have it. Peter, I too have a what is said to be a legitimate recording of a Bigfoot sound. I don't know whether you've ever heard this, but take a second and listen to this.
Thank you.
That, Peter, was recorded in this country by some researchers, mm-hmm. said to be a Bigfoot scream. And the way he described that, of course, we didn't hear it, but the way he described it, it sounded sort of the same.
Well, I'll tell you, having done the show on Bigfoot and then coming to this Yowie phenomenon, I was impressed. The number of people that come forward on this, there was one neighborhood where apparently 60 people have seen this in one area.
Mm-hmm.
It's so common that they actually, they basically went on a chase with it every night. They go chase it through the bush, and they'd hear it stomping like a freight train moving in front of them. There was the school teacher, Neil, his family was like something like Harry and the Hendersons. I mean, they had this animal in their backyard swamp, and the kids knew about it, and it was, oh yeah, we're going to go down and try and, have another encounter with this thing.
Well, in this country, Peter, people paint Bigfoot as gigantic, extremely strong, but very shy, avoiding man almost every opportunity it gets, and then when it does have interaction with man, it's very friendly. It's generally very friendly, but this doesn't sound friendly at all.
No, the juvenile versions of them, that's the one Neil saw, they're talking about an animal about 6 feet high, that they decided it liked to play hide-and-seek with them, and it would come by, they'd leave food out for it, it would take the food. I saw the areas, I mean, they're talking about, huge, trees and bushes have been pushed out of the way. It's not something sort of a person jogging down a trail would do. So they're talking about something that leaves a big footprint on the land, so to speak. When it moves, it just crashes and moves everything out of the way. And our Yowie hunters have had incidents where they've had rocks thrown at them.
That's typical of Bigfoot as well.
Yes.
So it may well be the same creature, but with a distinctly different temperament. Bigfoot is, I've always thought, a eater of vegetation, that sort of thing. What you're describing sounds like a killer.
Yeah, there's some pretty nasty stories about, finding sort of large animals partly up trees that have been, ripped apart by one of these things, and there's actually, if you wanted to know more about it, they have a really good site, YowieHunters.com, AHR. They have like reports all the time about these things, and they go out and really investigate them. They're very, very serious about their investigations and what they're trying to do. And another thing that's very unusual, and I guess a bit comical to some people, is that these Yowies leave these bite marks in trees, and it's because in Australia they have these beetle grubs, and there's a big debate on this, and we talked to scientists about it, and they said it's black cockatoos that do this, and they rip the trees apart because they look like even canine marks on the trees. And as Dean said, this cockatoo, if it's a cockatoo, it better have a tape measure going along at 6 foot intervals. So it's very unusual, and I've seen examples of these bite marks that they leave behind.
I'm curious, if you were to get lucky enough to go out with a group, and there you are with your camera, and you actually get into the presence of one of these things, a professional as you are, do you really think you could keep the camera pointed and really stay on the job, or would you beat feet?
Well,
you ever wonder about that? I mean, after all, you do go out, so you may eventually encounter.
I mean, I've shot wildlife, and I've shot some dangerous animals, and I was just down in Mexican caves looking for blind cave tarantulas. So I've been in some fairly dangerous and tricky situations.
Let's roll over that again. You were just in Mexico in caves looking for what?
It's for an Animal Planet show I'm directing called Spider Mania.
Yes.
And it's coming up on the 30th, and Basically, we went into these caves to shoot, film a never-before-seen blind cave tarantula.
And
we
had, my God.
We had to go a mile underground to find this, and it was a actual chasm that had been carved out during the flash floods. And the walls were kind of damp, and we were kind of hoping that it wasn't going to rain while we were down there.
You must have lost your mind. Tell me, I've heard a lot of stories about, and I wonder if you have too, about things that live beneath the earth. I'm sure spiders are down there. And by the way, did you find them?
We did, and then we found some even bigger ones in Venezuela that are the size of dinner plates. And then we cooked them up with the natives down there and ate them.
What did you really? You say spiders the size of dinner plates?
Yeah, 12 inches across. And these guys revere them as messengers of the dead. They speak to these, in the hallucinogenic drug ritual, they speak to these spiders. And through the spiders, like a conduit to the underworld, and they speak to their ancestors. And when things get tight with the blowgun huntings, they pull the spiders out of their dens and they cook them up in a big barbecue. And we were at one of those, and I got to taste a leg, and it was pretty interesting.
Tastes like chicken?
Actually, it tasted like prawn. That's the interesting part. They're big crabs, basically.
How do you talk yourself into going, into a mile deep into a cave? How do you do that?
I had a true fear factor moment there, actually, as I was descending down, especially because they told us it was going to be a walk in the park, and, you know, it says, oh, yeah, you just walk straight in, it's, you know, easy, you know, and you go in, and I'm looking at a chasm in the ground that is as wide as my shoulders, and we're basically going down this corkscrew tunnel, you know, where you're basically stooped over and your head is grazing the ceiling.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff really scares me.
And as you go deeper and you go, gee, I hope this doesn't go on for a mile like this, you know?
Which it did, I guess.
Well, it actually, after a couple of hundred yards, it actually cleared up into a bigger chamber. But then to get to the next chamber, we had to crawl on our hands, well, actually on our stomachs. We had to crawl underneath this huge slab for about another, I don't know, maybe 150 yards to get into the bigger chamber. And there was water down there. There were scorpions in there. There were vampire bats.
Vampire bats. What sort of legends have you heard? And believe me, I've heard a lot from Native Americans I've had on the air here about a whole underworld that we don't even know about. We know so little about the ground beneath us, the water beneath our seas. We know more about near space than we do about these things.
That's true, actually. I think that's the great, you know, other than the deep oceans, you know, that what's inside the earth is
you bet.
Another great unknown. And I don't know. It's hard to say. I guess it's, you know, ever since Journey to the Center of the Earth, there have been stories of alternate worlds down there and, indeed, you know, whole new forms of life. I did hear, I was investigating a story about caves in Romania where they virtually discovered a lost world of primarily, you know, smaller, you know, reptiles and bats and what have you, but it was literally, this was about 1995, 96, and they discovered all these new species. They just cracked open this cave, and inside were all of these unknown species that had never been discovered before.
Uh-huh. And if you could get down far enough, you have to wonder what indeed might be down there. I've had a lot of stories, legit stories of extremely deep holes. Have you you heard any rumors about that sort of thing? I mean, in a sense, you've already heard them, but I mean, really, apparent endless holes.
Well, I actually seem to remember hearing quite an interesting one on your show one night, which was some kind of hole where someone had been, like, putting miles of fish line down into
that
it.
That would be Mel Waters, yeah.
Yeah.
And he has now found a second hole
that you might be interested in, located here in the state of Nevada. And the people doing investigation, follow-up investigation on this hole, are finding people in the area of the original Mel's hole up in Washington State that are backing his story about this hole. While nobody's actually, you know, an organized party has found it yet, they are looking, and they think they're closing in on it, and they think they know roughly where it is. So there may be some portholes to some other place below us in the earth.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. In my film Sasquatch Odyssey, The Hunt for Bigfoot, we actually went in some caves around Mount St. Helens. And I think you've had Ray Crow on your show before.
Oh, yes.
And we were with his group. But they, I know that there are people that believe that Bigfoot actually gets around in a network of tunnels. And there is a theory about that.
That would account for a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Regarding the sightings of Bigfoot, that really would account for a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know why I like monsters, but I do. Sitting here doing the show, talking to you, I like monsters. But is seeing one? No, thank you. Listen, we'll hold you around.
I personally do not believe or disbelieve on a chupacabra.
We'll be back here in a moment. What we're going to do is, that was actually more on the chupacabra. What we're going to do here is to take a break. And when we do get back, what I want to do is have you answer some phone calls. I mean, a lot of people are kind of into monsters, so if you wouldn't mind answering some questions about monsters.
Sure.
Okay, then we'll consider that a done deal. Stay right where you are. When we get back, we will open the lines and let you ask, or who knows, maybe some of you have sightings of some of these things. They are obviously, they're out there. But what are they? To us, and have they always been there, or do they sort of come and go? From the high desert, I'm going to go now, and then we'll come back. I'm Art Bell.
In the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
It is. Peter von Puttkamer is my guest. He's a monster hunter. I'll let that loose title stick. And we're talking about all kinds of monsters, and you're invited to participate in this hour. We're going to open up the cell phone lines. We do have one more. I don't know if you'd call it a monster or not. The Tasmanian tiger. We'll talk about that Tasmanian tiger. Oh, and by the way, Mary in New Mexico says, referring to the picture on my website, which you all can see, let me tell you one more time, go to tonight's guest, and you'll see a World Trade Center, Devil or Angel, something like that. Click on that. That's the picture we're talking about. Tonight's guest. That's where to find it at artbell.com. Now, Mary says, you know, that picture looks more like either the angel of death or a dragon. I'm not sure. But God says in the end times, you'll see signs and wonders. Don't concern yourself with them. But says Mary, it's hard not to. All right, back now to my guest, Peter. You're back on the air again, and I guess we're going to talk a little bit about the Tasmanian tiger before we take any calls here. It's the last item that I've got on the list here. What is the Tasmanian tiger?
Story, and it's unfolding as we speak. Tasmanian tiger was a creature, a real animal. It looks like a cross between a kangaroo and a wolf, and it has tiger stripes, and it would hop initially like a kangaroo and then run more like a wolf-like gait.
Oh.
It had a huge jaw, 120-degree gait, more like a reptile than a mammal.
Oh, my God.
And it was perceived as a monster by the settlers. They thought it was killing their sheep. It was labeled a vampire. They found that it was drinking blood and internal organs and leaving the rest of the animal. And so there was a government bounty put on its head, and supposedly it was wiped out. Last one died in a zoo in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
Our monster hunter, Cole Bailey, has seen it. He saw the creature about 25 years ago, and he's been looking for it ever since. He's since heard it. He's had an encounter he's just missed it, where his father was a trapper. He knows about hunting these things, and he smelt it. He knew it was there, and he's also heard the distinctive yip. In the meantime, the Australian Museum has a 150-year-old fetus of one of these animals preserved in alcohol.
Really?
They have now extracted enough DNA from it to clone one. It would be the first time in human history that an extinct species would be brought back to life.
Is that a good idea?
Well, that's what we address in the show, because we're saying, okay, so the settlers thought the old one was a monster. Wait till they start cooking around with this one. You're going to really create a monster.
Let's give them a little taste of what we've got here. We've got a Colonel Bailey, who's a monster hunter, on a camping experience, and then this Dr. Michael Archer from the Australian Museum discusses a cloning experiment, which is about to bring back the Tasmanian tiger from extinction. So those two cuts coming up right now. First, Colonel Bailey.
It was early one morning. Out of nowhere came this mysterious yip-yip, like a fox terrier dog, a high-pitched yip-yip, and almost immediately an echo, like that. I was fascinated. Now, this is exactly as old Bushman had told me the tiger sounds like. I knew then, in my own mind, that the tiger was there. It gave me great satisfaction to hear that.
All right, and now Dr. Michael Archer, who apparently is prepared, has enough DNA to bring this thing back. Listen to this.
We've discovered that a pickled pup of a thylacine, an animal we all thought and accept broadly as extinct, has been extinct since 1936, was actually preserved by a collector in Tasmania in 1866. In pickling this pup, he passed into the future the possibility that its DNA could be preserved. So we dipped into this pickled pup just on the off chance and against a storm of people who said it's impossible, you'll never find it. And when we came up, there was this wonderful high quality DNA in vast quantities. We have the thylacine's complete DNA.
Yeah. Great. So this sounds like something out of Jurassic Park.
Yes.
That's what they did in Jurassic Park, right?
That's correct. And the Australian Museum, they seem to be in a bit of a race with the mammoth people, because there's a group trying to clone a mammoth, and the mammoth people aren't having much luck.
Well, woolly mammoth?
Yeah, the woolly mammoth. Based on the frozen carcass that they found in ice in Siberia. And so this is much further along. And they estimate it could cost as much as $30 million to do this. And to actually clone this animal, they have to use some of the DNA from an existing species that's related to it. And that, in that case, it's a Tasmanian devil.
How good of an idea do you think this is? I'm serious. How good an idea do you personally believe this is?
Well, I I don't think it's a good idea to be tinkering around with something in nature like this. I mean, we have no idea. Okay, so maybe the first one will be okay, but, you know, what is going to be the impact down the road? And what, you know, when you bring something like this into the world?
Here'd be my thinking. The natural course of events, as evolution plods on and time plods on, is that some animals become extinct for some specific reason. Either what they eat is gone, or, you know, climate change has, or something or another has changed so that they're extinct, whatever it is that causes an animal to go extinct. But if you bring them back into the modern world that's not ready for them, inevitably, as they said in Jurassic Park, there's some mathematical formula that covers this, but it's going to go all wrong.
Yeah, it's quite possible. That's what's so great about this. I mean, what's great about this story is you have sort of one man against the world. I mean, there are other thylacine. It's called a thylacine, another name for the Tasmanian tiger. There's more than one thylacine hunter, but really Cole Bailey has been leading the charge here, and he, you know, he's in a race against time now to prove that this animal exists before science goes ahead and tries to clone this thing and maybe creates another monster.
Do you have any idea what their timetable is?
Oh, there's a documentary being made as we speak about this cloning, and it's an ongoing documentary. They're talking about, you know, just a few years kind of thing.
All right. Look, we're going to go and take some phone calls now, and let's see what's out there. But that one I'm not so sure of at all. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Peter. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Art. Hello, Art. Hi, Peter.
Hi there.
I've been listening to Art Show for a long time, and that gave me the opportunity to hear different sounds that are emitted by different creatures.
Yes.
And connecting the dot, it seems to me, and I have that question, what do you think about it, is that to me some of these creatures are definitely genetically engineered by aliens. And I say this because of the metallic and machine quality, like of the scream or the sounds they make, and also the energy they have. And, you know, in opposition with real Earth monsters that I know exist too, you can feel have a natural quality to them of the Earth. I don't know how to explain this very well, but
I think you're doing very well. In other words, you're saying that the sound that some of these monsters make is not one of native Earth.
No.
Yeah, that actually makes sense. And then in other cases, it is easily quantifiable as being from our native Earth. You agree with that, Peter?
I think that's. I hadn't actually heard that before. I think that's a.
In other words,
fantastic thought. I hadn't really thought
okay,
of it that way.
Substitute. We did talk about the paranormal, right?
Yep.
So you could substitute alien for paranormal. In other words, one way or the other, not of this natural Earth. And some of the sounds are sort of alien in that sense to us, almost mechanical sounding, as she said, while others, you could imagine, would be of this natural Earth, even if rare.
You'd kind of have to go through these creatures and pick out the biologically based ones and the ones that were more in the realm of, you know, the paranormal or demonic or what have you, or even in the case of the chupacabra, I mean,
you
I
said
well be something an alien
pet
creature of some kind.
You said, I think you said alien pet that got loose.
Yeah, well, that was certainly one of the theories.
Yeah. Wild card line, you're on the air with Peter. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
This is Cat.
Hi.
From near San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
Back in the 50s when I was in college, at several of the bull sessions that we were involved in, we had this Texan there. And he was telling us all these fantastic stories, including some about pterodactyls down the Big Bend area.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of passed them off and file them for future reference, laughingly, until a couple of the people who were related to exozoology on your show happened to mention Texas sightings of pterodactyls.
Yes.
I'll grant you there's an awful lot about places we don't know, and even here in the San Francisco Bay Area, I know for doggone sure there are places in the Santa Cruz Mountains where a man has never put his foot.
That's truth. That's truth. I've been up in those mountains. He's absolutely right. So even in the places that we consider the most urban of all, nearby there are areas, as he points out, Santa Cruz Mountains are a really good example, that are just absolute, total, for the most part, untouched wilderness, places where man has never put his foot. Peter?
The pterodactyl thing is fascinating to me, especially because tonight someone actually emailed me an image, and I'm sure, Art, you've probably seen this one. I had only ever seen sketches of this. It appears to be some Civil War soldiers with what looked like a downed pterodactyl lying on the ground in front of them.
You know, I don't think I have seen that. I know your wife is with you during the show tonight, isn't she?
My wife?
Or assistant or some female.
She could get on the line if you like.
No. What I was asking is, yeah. Perhaps you could email me that photograph.
Oh, sure.
Can you send that over to me?
Yes, we could do that.
All right. Let me clear my email box right now. It's artbell@mindspring.com.
Okay.
Because I don't think that I've seen what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, we'll work on that.
All right. Let's work on that, and maybe through the bottom of the hour, I can get that to my webmaster very quickly. It's artbell@mindspring.com.
Yeah, it's a fascinating picture. It'd be worth knowing, like, where exactly it came from and how authentic it is.
All right, please fire it to me, and we'll get it up on the web right away.
Okay.
All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Peter Von Puttkamer. Hi.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Peter.
Where are you?
I'm in Denver.
Denver, okay.
My question for Peter is this. Have you ever run across a claim of someone who has had an encounter with Bigfoot, of hearing it speak or having or speaking to it or having any type of conversation?
Oh.
Or was it just sightings?
No, I've had, well, of course, you probably had this fellow Jack Lapsaritis on your show. Have you ever had him on your show?
He's written
a book called The Psychic Sasquatch, but he claims to have had several encounters with Sasquatches that did actually speak to him. Some of the more hard-nosed people like Renee DeHinden or Dr. Grover Krantz, they probably wouldn't go along with that. But
I've had recordings on the air.
Yes.
Of Bigfoot. And they some of it's pretty scary stuff. It's very guttural and hard to hear, but sometimes unmistakable. Now, who can ever know if these are genuine recordings, but they're pretty hair-raising.
Well, I'm talking about coming up and speaking in English.
Yeah, so am I.
And addressing. Yeah, is that okay? Yeah.
I've actually had these recordings on the air, Peter.
Okay.
They're astounding. So, you know, I west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Peter. Good morning.
Hello, Art.
Hello. Peter. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Tucson.
Okay.
Yeah, reference Sasquatch and Chupacabra?
Chupacabra, yes.
Chupacabra. I have a comment, maybe a question. Whereas a Sasquatch, I believe, is a primate who has learned to use the underground for his survival. And Chupacabra, I believe, is an animal from the underground worlds who has learned to use the surface for maybe some of his survival, reference food.
Yeah,
that's a comment. And the question is, has Chupacabra been described as reptilian at all? I'm thinking of the draconian races.
Well, that's a good question. Now, in what class, Peter, would Chupacabra?
I've heard various ideas about that. We in our show decided to go with the reptilian, it made the most sense to have the reptilian. I have heard of hair covered and so on, but everything else about the creature is very reptilian. The claws, sort of slithering appendage that comes out of its mouth, yeah. Even descriptions of the skin and of course the spikes that come off the head and down the back.
Spikes and scales, right?
And scales,
that sounds very reptilian.
But there is a sort of school of thought about this that talks about fur, and it seemed a little, didn't seem to quite fit to me, but I could be wrong.
Your show, the one that you put together, how can it be seen? Where can it be seen?
Our program called Monster Hunters.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yes, it's on TLC. There's actually two episodes that we've done right now, and this is our pilot. We've done six segments. There's three in each segment, in each episode.
When would be the next opportunity?
So the date is May 7th.
May 7th.
At 9 o'clock on TLC, the Learning Channel.
The Learning Channel, yes.
Yes, and check your local listings. And June 25th at 10 o'clock.
All right, see if you can email that to me, and we'll get those times on again for the show, and we'll be right back with Peter.
In the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
It certainly is. Good morning, everybody. My guest is Peter von Puttkamer, and in a moment, we've got, a colleague of hers, Jason Walton, who is a caddy researcher. We'll find out what that is in just a moment. Stay right where you are. All right, we're going to, I'm going to send this again, just to make sure. I want to get it up on the website right away for all of you. This is an amazing, amazing picture. So let's see. Let me send it to a different address. Okay. Got to do this sometimes on the fly. So there it goes to yet another address. All right. This amazing photograph, which I have just sent off to Keith to get up on the web. And this is, oh my God, what?
Pretty wild.
Pretty wild is right, Peter. this would appear to be from the Civil War era, huh?
Mm-hmm.
These are obviously Civil War soldiers standing, one guy with his foot on this. What in the hell is that? What is that?
Well, it looks like a perfect depiction. I mean, it looks like a pterodactyl to me.
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah.
A gigantic one. I mean, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 Civil War soldiers spaced out and still not covering how long this thing is, eh?
Right.
Holy mackerel.
So someone emailed that to me tonight, and asked me if I knew anything about it. And now I have talked to one person up here who's a bit of a crypto specialist, and he felt that this was actually a hoax. But I haven't actually, I don't know how it was hoaxed, or if those are guys in costumes.
I agree with you. If that's a hoax, that's something.
Yeah.
We'll have it up, folks. I'm not sure where. In just a moment, I'll let you know as soon as Keith gets it up, which would be a matter of a couple of minutes, I would guess. In the meantime, we've got somebody we want to bring on with Peter, and we should have probably done it a little earlier. I'm terribly sorry about that. Jason Walton, welcome to the program.
Hello, how you doing?
Pretty good. You've been listening along?
Sure.
Okay, what do you think about all this, and where do you fit in?
Oh, well, I'm strictly just involved with the Cabrasaurus off Victoria, Vancouver Island, B.C.
Okay, well, can you tell us about it?
Well, what we have is about 300 years, starting back with native folklore and myth of a large serpentine animal, anywhere from 30 to 60 feet long, that people have been seeing, and right up to this very day, and reporting off the waters here on the island. And we started a group called Caddy Scan in 1999,
mm-hmm.
With Ed Bousfield and Paul LeBlanc, a couple of marine biologists who had previously written a book. And now we're trying to find some sort of definitive footage or physical evidence for this unknown animal.
And how did the two of you come together?
I actually phoned up, and this is me and Peter, sorry?
Yes.
Oh, well, Peter gave me a call, and he was doing a documentary, and he said he would love to do something on the Cadbrosaurus, mainly because I think no one's ever really heard about it, and they were trying to cover animals that not a lot of people might have heard. And as far as Loch Ness and these other lake monsters, there's a lot of the Ogopogo, there's a lot of stuff on this, but Cadbrosaurus has kind of remained one of Victoria's best-kept secrets.
Are there any photographs in existence or just sightings?
The two best photographs we have are from a book called Whalers No More from Captain Hagelin. And there were two very clear photographs in 1937 off the Queen Charlotte Islands of a specimen, a dead specimen, that was pulled out of a stomach of a sperm whale. And these guys got really excited about it. And unfortunately, it was one of these things that was sent to someone who was unqualified, dismissed it as something else.
Yes, I think we heard about that earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And they basically, during times of war, they chucked it away. So that was lost to us.
They chucked it away. Well, listen, this photograph that I was talking about for my audience, we've done it again, folks. He got it here, and I got it to my webmaster, and my webmaster, Keith, got it up again right under Peter's name. You'll now see a third image, and a pterodactyl with soldiers, it says. And you might want to take a look at this. Have both of you seen this? I'd expect not, huh?
Photograph of the pterodactyl.
Yeah.
Oh, Peter emailed that to me. Peter, what was the date on that?
You mean the actual image of when
was
it was
this taken? Something that was kind of unearthed in the last few weeks?
Well, no. Apparently, it's been around a long time, and the image that I've always seen was a sketch based on that photograph.
No kidding. So,
yeah.
So now for the first time we've got an actual, and it does certainly, it obviously is a photograph, my God. And it's very, very old. Or if somebody went to the trouble to fake all this, I just don't know how they would have done it.
Photoshop 4 is quite good. I think a lot of these guys, there's actually another photograph of a pterodactyl I looked at. It turned out that someone had unearthed right after that a picture of some, it was back in the 1800s, I think they had shot some criminals, and they were displaying them and all standing around. And what the people had done is they had taken out the criminals and superimposed this giant pterodactyl-like carcass. And it was a different photograph, but very similar.
It really is a terrible problem we have in modern days. The only thing that you can say is, before we got, you know, Photoshop 4 and 5 and whatever, before all of this stuff was available, before computers, we had Polaroids. And a lot of people got shots of these same creatures with Polaroids, right?
Yeah, well, that's what's great about this Cadbosaurus picture. Hey, 1937, no Photoshop, and this thing's just lying there, and you know, it's pretty wild. It's really hard. There would have been no way to fake it, and as the old timer told us, they didn't have time for no hoaxes. They were busy working every day.
You can also request the original pictures if you like in the BC archives, and that is free, and they have the original snapshots down there with the date.
Well,
donated by the fellow who took the pictures.
So are you going to stay on the hunt?
Most definitely. If people continue to call us and report these things, which happens every year, probably about 5 times, we don't get that many. We do have 24-hour cameras up now that can be accessed through the internet by ourselves. And with any luck, we're hoping to get something. Also working with the local fishing community in hopes of what happens when they bring up their nets and what's called podcast catch.
Tell them about that commercial fisherman, Jason, that you've been working with.
And which one was that?
The fellow where you've set up the camera and he saw the humps, the fire-like humps.
This is Bob. Oh, geez, what's his last name now? And we set it up in his backyard. And I think it was 1998, I'm terrible with dates, he was outside and he saw something that he had never seen before, tire-like humps suddenly appearing, moving in a straight line, moving so quickly, he couldn't believe the speed. A lot of the people that see these things can't believe the speed that they move at.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, a number of years later, he found my name and was very happy to hear that he agreed to a permanent camera installation at his place. So we have this running on motion sensor 24 hours a day.
This is the guy who's seen big sea lions, he's seen killer whales, he knows marine life, he spent his life on the water, and he saw this thing and said, this is something different.
Which most of these guys do. There's a lot of guys that run tours and things like that, and one fellow that was off in a local marina with a tour group, and the thing with the Cadbosaurus is that we do not really take seriously sightings with bumps unless it is someone quite knowledgeable, like a commercial fisherman, but some people report animals with 12-foot necks, horse-like head, and several loops behind.
Okay, well, again, I've got to ask this question of you, Jason. We covered it earlier, but, I mean, even if we actually get a live specimen of one of these things, we live in such a, a cynical Photoshop world.
Yes.
That I don't care how live it is. You know, it's liable to go on tour, and everybody will view it as some sort of weird oddity or malformation of something, or, you know, they'll call it a million things, but will they really scientifically admit, here's what we've got? I don't know. I don't think that's too likely. How about you?
Well, I think Ed or Paul, being the scientists, they could better answer this question. A number of things could happen. I actually hope that if it happens, it is a dead specimen so that we don't have to go through, you know, all the moral decisions of what's going to happen next. There's every possibility we might get a live one. We do have considerations for live marinas here on the island that are friends of theirs that will deal with this if this happens, because we have had a lot of reports of people walking down the beach and seeing what they describe as baby dragons.
So then there's actually a plan in place should this occur?
Yeah, we have sort of there's a plan for, you know, say, a dead carcass or a live one, but you do have to make these just in case. One in a million chance.
There was a lady who reported finding a juvenile one on the beach and then dragging it back into the water, right?
What?
And that was right before, that was actually on John's Island, and about a year before, there was actually a period of 2 years. There was a couple of ladies, different parts of one was in BC and one was on John's Island in Washington, and they had both seen large, what you would call a very large animal on the beach. And in John's Island, she saw this animal, and in the morning time on a walk, she saw something she'd never seen scuttling around in the sand, and she picked it up with a stick and put it back into the water.
Put it back in the water. That just must kill you.
See what I said about the Native Indian stuff earlier. They know that these things come up on the beach. It's part of their education for their young people. They tell them, go to that island because that's where the serpents come up out of the water, and they come on the beach. And there's different theories about them maybe birthing up there or going for, you know, fresh water or God knows what. But there's, you know, they might be like turtles, you know, that have to come ashore for these sorts of things.
It's really hard to say. As Ed sometimes has theorized, that these might be animals that give birth to live young and may come into warm channels or be it right onto land to give birth. And it's sort of, the whole thing is kind of ending up more like a detective story than a mystery, really, of tying all this stuff together and whether this is the same species or not. Have been seen at the same location, as well as, somebody might report something that looks a little different, maybe male-female sexual dimorphism, larger heads, perhaps a mane. It's fascinating what we hear, and what the information that comes from are from blue-collar Canadians and people in careers. They have absolutely nothing to gain by phoning us up.
Sure.
They have everything to lose, so it keeps me speechless constantly.
Jason, I'm sure you heard Peter earlier talking about what they're going to do with this Tasmanian tiger. You know, they've got this DNA, and they're going to try and bring back this extinct animal. I suppose there are other monsters, like the one that you're hunting, that you might get a piece of or get some DNA of or something like that. One might imagine you'd get a piece of one, and then you get the DNA so you could create these things. And apparently they're ready to create something that doesn't really belong on Earth right now. How would you feel about that process?
Oh, well, I don't know. That's the big moral issue, isn't it?
Isn't it?
It's like people introducing species to get rid of another species, and then surprisingly they go, geez, something really bad's happening. maybe
oops.
Stop and learn. I don't know.
Yeah, the big oops.
Yes. And then another oops a few years later. So I don't know. With the DNA, it's one of those things that people should say, it's all right. Let's put that law into fact, and as long as nobody goes over that. But, of course, someone's always going to want to go further and further. So,
right.
No answer.
I want to get this on again for sure, because a lot of people are going to ask. The show is coming up May 5th, you said.
No, May 7th.
May 7th.
May 7th.
Ooh, important distinction. May 7th on
May 7th at 9 o'clock on the Learning Channel on TLC.
Okay.
And also on June 25th, that's actually episode 2, June 25th at 10 o'clock, you know, check your local listings. The first episode covers Jersey Devil, UK Phantom, Big Cats, and Chupacabra. And then episode 2 is Cadbosaurus, Yowie, and this Tasmanian tiger.
In other words, we've kind of gone through both episodes tonight, but if you want to see the visuals and the interviews, it's all going to be on the Learning Channel. How did you hook up, I'm curious, with the Learning Channel versus, a million other shows?
Well, mostly because we produced our show, Sasquatch Odyssey, The Hunt for Bigfoot, which we are actually selling, and you can, you know, people can pick up from us on our Monster Hunter site or SasquatchOdyssey.com. That one we produced in 99, won a lot of awards for it, and we actually sold it to TLC. And on the strength of that, we talked to them about, you know, more monsters and more people that are looking for them. And they were intrigued and backed us on this series.
What about you, Jason? Do you have a view on why people like monsters so much?
Oh, well, it's fun. I mean, I watch a lot of movies myself. Yeah, me too. It's something that I've always been interested in, the mysterious aspect of it all, with animals and the unknown earth and all that. It's great stuff. It's great stuff. And, of course, legends and sea serpents and all that. The etchings and all this, and then to actually be talking to someone who's describing that,
mm-hmm.
It's the most fascinating thing I've ever been a part of.
Gentlemen, is there any place on Earth that doesn't have monsters? I mean, we have plenty of them in this country, but I mean, do either one of you know of any place on Earth that doesn't have legends and reports of monsters?
A difficult one to answer.
The only place I could think of would be like the Antarctic, because I'm sure there are tales in the Arctic about monsters.
Woolly mammoths or something. I'm not sure.
Well, that's where James R. Ness was.
Well, you know, there's all kinds of fantastic stories. I mean, extinct species, so-called extinct species or primeval species that may still be around is another whole branch of cryptozoology. For example, the search for the giant sloth in Chile. And you know,
The giant what?
The giant sloth.
Sloth, oh, okay.
Like the ground sloth?
Right.
Those things are huge. They're like 10 feet high. They have fangs about 5 inches long, and they weigh about 2,000 pounds. And they have actually found evidence that basically, early Native Americans were corralling these and penning them like cattle in caves and, like, domesticating them. They were around at the same time, 5,000 to 10,000 years ago. These things still walked around the New World. And there are suggestions that these animals may still be there. So we're looking at a whole, you know, doing more of these programs. We're hoping there's a public interest in this, and we want to do...
There's a gigantic interest in this.
Yeah. And, you know, we all kind of grew up watching, you know, the In Search of shows and the Arthur C. Clarke shows, and there really hasn't been a lot, in my mind, that's been provocative and interesting, and I wanted to do something different that looked at the monster hunters and used the latest technology and night vision and all the hardware we've got now to make a really fascinating and entertaining show, and that's what we set out to do.
Well, you certainly set out to do it tonight and achieved it, Jason. I want to thank Jason, and I want to thank you, certainly, Peter, for everything tonight and providing all those cuts and kind of as a, you know, a teaser for the show coming up on TLC. I'll be there on May 7th on TLC, as I hope my audience will. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Appreciate it.
Good night to both of you. There you have it, folks. Monsters. Get a shiver in the dark. It's raining in the park. Meantime, you're going to want to check out this picture we just got up there minutes ago. Came from Peter. It's called Paradactyl with Soldiers. A band is blowing Dixie, double ball time. Absolutely wild stuff. From the high desert, good night. Feel all right when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside.